if you're staring at a cornfield, you could stand on the sidelines and you can say, man, how on earth am I going to go harvest millions of kernels of corn? What am I going to do? Where do I even start? How do I begin? Or you can roll your sleeves up and just start going one by one. And that is often what we have found to be one of the most effective methods of gathering this information is call, email, send notes, go down to the office if you have to, and just ask for the information. It's a real challenge. There are some jurisdictions where, you know, the election officials mean well, but sometimes they don't understand why we want the information. They're like, well, why do you want to know the candidate list? Well, you know, we want to put the information out there. Why? No, you can't have that. We encounter that sometimes, and then we've just got to, you know, keep working and hopefully get it.
You're entering the voting booth. I'm John Fortier of AEI.
And I'm Don Palmer with the Election Assistance Commission.
Welcome to the podcast that looks at the inner workings of elections.
Our guest today is Jeff Pillay. He's Ballotpedia's editor-in-chief, and he's been in that role since March of 2015, overseeing Ballotpedia's editorial department. Now, many of you know about Ballotpedia. It's basically a website and a webpage of election information, an encyclopedia of election administration, redistricting public policy. And Jeff has been intimately involved in launching many of the new projects since that time. Prior to joining Ballotpedia, Jeff was a policy analyst for the South Carolina Policy Council and copy editor for the Beaufort Gazette. He studied journalism and history at Emory University before earning a master's of public administration at the College of Charleston. Welcome to the voting booth, Jeff. Appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having me on the show, guys. I'm looking forward to talking all about Ballotpedia and politics.
Great. Well, I know we all use Ballotpedia. It's a great resource. And I know around AEI, the think tank, it's really something people know from the public-facing side. But maybe just a little more biographical. Can you tell us a little bit more of yourself, how you ended up there? And then maybe just some background of the size of Ballotpedia and your role.
Sure. So I started at Ballotpedia originally in June 2010. So I've been there a little more than 14 years now. And back then, Ballotpedia was 8 people, maybe about 50,000 total articles. And we are closing in on almost 500,000 articles now. It's amazing just how many elections there are in this country. I mean, you know, you guys know this, your listeners know this, but there are more than 585,000 elected officials. Nearly all of them are local. And our journey has been ever growing with covering more and more of those elections, more and more of those candidates, more and more of those elected officials, and just helping voters, helping Americans to understand what it is on their ballot. What are they seeing when they go to the polls? They get this long piece of paper or this electronic, you know, this ballot. What do those names actually mean? Who stands behind those names? So Ballotpedia has been just marching along, trying to cover as many elections as we can, to cover the American political system, and really make it easier for voters to participate.
So since 2010, 2015, you mentioned that you have grown. What areas have you grown into? Did you just start covering everything, or did you basically advance as you went through the years? Let's start looking at legislation, or let's start looking at redistricting.
Yeah. So Ballotpedia started off with just covering what its namesake is, ballot measures. That's what we were created to do in 2007. The whole idea was, well, you know, there are these things called ballot measures, and those are kind of complicated. So our CEO and founder, Leslie Graves, she said, maybe it would be really great if there were some neutral, nonpartisan articles just about ballot measures. And so we built some of those, and, you know, we had some fun with that. And lo and behold, there was traffic. People found them. Our American political voters are naturally curious. That's one of the really cool discoveries of the Ballotpedia experiment. The voters want information. They crave it and they desire it. It's a very American mentality to not be told what to think, to not be told what to do. They want to seek the information out for themselves and make up their own mind. And that's what Ballotpedia does. So we started out with just ballot measures. And it was kind of funny. In the early years, we like to say things like, well, we cover the down ballot election. So when I started in 2010, it was all about state legislatures and maybe a little bit of school boards here and there. So the early years were just that, down ballot. And then over time, we eventually started adding in. It was in 2012, we started to add in Congress. And in 2016, we started covering the first presidential election that we covered. We didn't cover the 2012 election. So Ballotpedia has kind of gone cyclically. We started out small. Then we grew into other coverage areas with state executives, with the presidential election. And now, most recently, we're starting to grow down the ballot again, the tens and hundreds of thousands of local elections. So It's been a wonderful journey, and we love that the American population is curious to learn more.
So just following up, it intrigued me. You talk about the growth. Who is actually consuming? You mentioned the traffic. So talk to us a little bit, if you can share some of your numbers. Who's reading and consuming, and what are they looking at?
Yeah, it's a great question. So most of our users come through search, the side door, we like to say. Their people jump into their phone when they're getting ready to vote, or they're at the bar trying to settle a conversation with their friend, and they're saying, I want to find out some information. And they Google for it, or they search for it, or whatever they use. And they find a Ballotpedia article. And we hope, and we feel pretty confident, that we solve that for them. Typically, 1 in 2 voters come to Ballotpedia at some point during the voting season. That's kind of what we've seen over the last few years. And we think that should keep growing. We have a mixture of what we call our regular users, our sort of the routine voters, and they're coming to vote. They're coming to Ballotpedia just before they're getting ready to vote. And then there are the power users, the junkies, probably the people listening to this podcast who maybe come daily or weekly, and they're just constantly looking for and soaking in all of the political information that we hopefully make readily available to them.
So in addition to the broad information that you have tools or resources that are really meant to help voters or other officials out in certain specific ways. And I think we want to get into some of them. One of them is the sample ballot tool. And I want to hear about it. But first, just, you know, my own perspective of thinking about American elections and how complicated they are compared to European elections or other parliamentary style elections, where they have pretty simple ballots, 1 or 2 races, maybe. We have sometimes these enormous ballots. And, you know, people often don't absolutely know what their ballot is, where they are, and being able to sort of get at that ballot. Tell us a little bit about sort of how that came about, how it works, and, you know, what sort of niche you are filling here by having that tool.
Sure. So the sample ballot tool is one of our sort of favorite products that we make available. We're really proud of it. We've had that since 2014, and we just rolled out a sort of 3.0 version for this election cycle we think it's such a useful tool for voters. Everyone's sample ballot, everyone's ballot is different. And it's incredible because in some places in the country, the sample ballot, the ballot that you're going to get at the voting booth, is just handed to you by a clerk in a very small town. And it might be the first time you're seeing it because, you know, they don't really need to share that in advance, I guess you might say. Well, we wanted to make that available so that you could study up on the names who are on your ballot and find out about them just simply by plugging in your address. It's a really big challenge because getting the maps and the jurisdictions for voter precincts is a really big difficulty in this country because we have so many different districts. We have so many unique offices that cover different districts like mosquito commissioners and soil and water districts, things like that. So plugging in your address, you're going to get the names of who is running. And then hopefully, if we've been able to find information, which is always a challenge, we're going to give you information about the candidate. What are their stances? What's their biography? What do they believe in? And that should, hopefully, help voters come to the booth ready to vote. Don and I were talking the other day about it. It should help reduce lines at the polls because, you know, if a voter who's informed in advance, who knows what they believe in, who knows, okay, yeah, this ballot measure has 19 different op-eds that have been released about it, and here's what I believe, and here are the supporters, and here are the opponents, and here's where the money went, and now when I get to the booth and I see Proposition 1, well, I don't have to read it and spend 15 minutes trying to think out loud whether or not I want to vote for it or against it. I've made up my mind already because I studied up and I prepared, and now I can vote and move on.
And as we deal and have listeners that are election officials, they know that they are producing an incredible variety of ballot styles themselves. I think I remember some years ago we were with Dean Logan, who runs Los Angeles County, which is the largest local jurisdiction in America, larger than many states. And I don't have the exact number, but certainly hundreds and hundreds of ballot styles, because you have people in different congressional districts and state legislative districts and local districts of all sorts. And so the number of ballots that the jurisdiction have might be tremendous. But, you know, maybe you could tell us a little bit some either fun facts or thoughts about ballots, either particularly long ballots or strange ballots, or what kind of information do you have about the variety of ballots that are out there in America?
It's really funny that you say that about Los Angeles, because I swear I did not share with you my notes in advance. But when we queried our database and we're looking at what are some of the jurisdictions with the most races in a single ballot, Los Angeles had the top 4 entries. March 5th, 2024, there were 298 unique, distinct races in Los Angeles in our database. Now, that doesn't mean that a voter had to vote in all 298 of those races, but Los Angeles is what shows up the most. Places like Dane, Wisconsin at 238 and Maricopa, Arizona at 221. These are just enormous ballots with a lot to sift through and vote through. So, yeah, when we play around looking through our database of hundreds of thousands of elections, there's quite a lot there. And, you know, that really actually brings up a really important point that I think people forget in this country, which is there are so many unique election days. There's almost an election a week in the United States. You know, we talk about this persistent election cycle that goes on, and it really truly is that for some voters. That's why some voters get very tired of elections, because there's always one here and always one there. And turnout really does decline when you're in a sort of off cycle election. We see that just persistently with the data. But yeah, Los Angeles has one of the most unique elections. Another one that we were pretty interested in is the most unique candidates on a ballot for one single election. We have one pretty interesting one coming up. There are 36 candidates on the ballot for 9 seats on the Lansing Charter Commission on May 7th, 2024, actually. The winners of this race will be tasked with revising and rewriting Michigan State Capital City's charter over the coming years. So that's quite a few people, 36 people running to and rewrite a city charter, which is one of those sort of really complicated elections that we see. And there's just a lot of that. We vote on a lot in this country. We really do.
So just following up, you talked about this, you know, the ballot tool, sample ballot. Now, one of the challenges of that is actually getting the data. And, yeah. You know, I don't want you to spill any trade secrets, but, you know, I can only imagine a number of people calling the localities in the state to try to get this information. And perhaps there's some automation that you figured out with artificial intelligence or just older tools. How do you get that information? It's just got to be such a, you know, treasure trove of info.
Yeah. A lot of patience, a lot of diligence, and a lot of effort. We like to say it's like staring out at a cornfield. Now, did not grow up a farmer, but I like the farmer analogies. If you're staring out at a cornfield, you could stand on the sidelines and you can say, man, how on earth am I going to go harvest millions of kernels of corn? What am I going to do? Where do I even start? How do I begin? Or you can roll your sleeves up and just start going one by one. And that is often what we have found to be one of the most effective methods of gathering this information is call, email, send notes, go down to the office if you have to, and just ask for the information. It's a real challenge. There are some jurisdictions where, you know, the election officials mean well, but sometimes they don't understand why we want the information. They're like, well, why do you want to know the candidate list? Well, you know, we want to put the information out there. Why? No, you can't have that. We encounter that sometimes, and then we've just got to, you know, keep working and hopefully get it. The biggest challenge at the local level is the timeline of turnaround. I think that's really, if I could snap my fingers, we would love to change that, because we were just talking about an election recently where in Spokane, Washington, the local ballot measures were not posted on the website until a week before the election. So that just doesn't give you a lot of time to find out about the election, to then research information about those ballot measures, to then post that information available. And at the local level, I think people don't always realize just how short the timeline is at times from filing deadline to when the election takes place.
Absolutely.
So that's a big challenge. Canceled elections are probably one of the most unknown challenges that we face in this country that voters might not really realize, is that sometimes if there's not enough candidates running, they just cancel the election. Now, if you're an election official, that makes total sense. Why spend the money and time and energy hosting an election for when it's a guarantee who's going to win? There's only one candidate on the ballot. So you cancel it. But if you're a voter, you're thinking, well, wait, I didn't get a chance to cast my vote. When did this person get into elected office? I don't remember voting for them. So that's always an interesting challenge, because at times if they cancel an election, they might not even publish that the election was going to take place in the first place. So there's a never-ending set of challenges, and the simplest way to get around it is to just have enough processes and systems in place that we are just constantly checking and looking in under every rock.
So one of the things that I've noticed over the last couple of years has been your election legislative tracker.
Yeah.
How does that work? I pretty much follow it occasionally, but could you talk a little bit about that and what trends you're seeing in election legislation?
Sure. So we obviously, Ballotpedia started off with, you know, covering ballot measures and then candidates and elected officials. And over the last few years, one of our new areas has been election legislation tracking. And then just really just legislation tracking in general, we just recently launched a new administrative state legislation tracker as well. So there are more than 150,000 or so pieces of legislation introduced in the United States every year. And that's quite a bit of legislation. That's a lot for anyone to go through, whether you're an average voter just trying to understand what's happening, or whether you're an activist or a lobbyist who's trying to follow it every day. So what we do is we sift through all of the bills, and we, you know, use the wonder and powers of AI and some tools that are existing out there. And we then categorize and tag all of the bills that are related to elections legislation. And what this lets you really understand is, what are the states that are moving bills related to elections? What are the states, what types of bills are moving? How is this affecting the elections administrative space? And the really big part of that we feel very proud about, that we think is really important, is we're doing this from a sort of Ballotpedia neutral perspective, where we're not casting judgment on whether a bill is voter suppression or election integrity or this, that, or the other. We're just simply here to say, hey, here's a bill and here's what it does. And, you know, you can read that and you can make up your mind as to what you think that actually means. And what we find is that there is a significant amount of legislation moving in many states and from both parties related to how the elections are governed and administered in this country. And it's just a really fast moving space right now.
And are there particular areas that you're seeing big spikes up, or new things that you hadn't seen 3 or 4 years ago, types of legislation that are popping up?
Yeah, so really, and what's interesting, and what you would obviously expect, is what matters most in terms of understanding the space is seeing which types of bills are being introduced and then moved in states based on which parties are in power. So if a Democrat introduces a bill in South Carolina, where I live, odds are, and it's in a Republican trifecta state, it's not going to pass. And if a Republican introduces a bill in Hawaii, well, that's pretty hard because there are very few Republicans in Hawaii, but odds are that's not going to pass either. So what you have to do, we try to focus our lens on what are the states where the party in power is introducing legislation and moving it. So you find in Republican states, you're seeing things like Zuckerberg bill bans, private funding bans is what they're calling them, ranked choice voting bans. Those are some of the new types of bills, different legislation around how audits are run. So you see these kind of bills permeating in Republican states. In Democratic states, you're seeing things related to mail-in voting. You're seeing bills related to early voting, related to how voter rolls are maintained, or how online registration is maintained. Everyone is doing different tactics, and you guys all follow it very close to yourselves as well. But that's what's kind of interesting, is that they have their own minds on what reforms make the most sense, and they go into their states and they introduce bills.
So we started with some of the newer tools, but maybe I could take you back to maybe your beginning or your bread and butter of the ballot measures, right?
Yeah.
And one, I'd love to hear, you know, generally about it, but two, just from a perspective of election administrators, people running elections who are listening, there are obviously questions of, you know, how many votes each ballot measure gets, but there are also lots of questions about qualification, states imitating each other. What types of things would you tell election officials? First, tell us generally about your tool, but what would you tell election officials, the kind of information that you are collecting that would help us understand this process better?
Yeah. Ballot measures, they're just such an interesting space. The best thing I think I would say about ballot measures is the trends typically seem to follow who's controlling state legislatures. Ballot measures are expensive. They're expensive to get on the ballot, especially for initiatives. So if someone wants to fund a $3 million initiative campaign, they'd better believe it's going to actually get on the ballot in the first place. And what we see happen over time is the states where the state legislature, let's say in the 1990s, where there were a lot of Democratic-controlled states, you saw a lot of conservative-leaning ballot measures because that's where they felt like they could spend their money best. Now we're seeing kind of the counter, where Republicans control more state legislatures, so you're seeing more ballot measures come from the left a little bit more because they are seeing that as their avenue for legislative change. You've seen that in recent years with some of the abortion and marijuana measures. For us, ballot measures is about collecting as much information as we can on what are the proposed ballot measures, who's supporting them, what are the positions behind them, what are the arguments. In some respects, I wish that election campaigns ran like ballot measures, because it's actually painted very concretely in the ballot measure world. When it's filed, you get a support camp and you get an opposition camp. And then they release arguments. And you just go look at them. You say, okay, well, these are the reasons why the support side says you should vote for this ballot measure. Great. Now you can read that and you can know that. Okay, here's the opposition. Here are the reasons they believe you should vote against it. And you read that and now you know that. God, that would be so simple if that's how candidate campaigns ran, but it's usually not that simple. So ballot measures are really kind of, in some respects, we find them to be very neat and linear like that.
Just a little bit of a follow-up. Are you able to get at some of these ballot measures on the early side at the qualification standpoint, when people are saying, we've got to collect this number of signatures, we're going to get on there? And then second, you know, each state is different. Of course, some states don't have as many and some states are easier, but they also have different features that sometimes the ballot measure, if it passes, it's going to be law or it's going to be part of the Constitution. Other times it's going to go to the legislature and it's going to be advisory in some way. So do you follow and how are you able to sort of pull together all that sort of information around it, how that ballot process is working as well as the substance of the ballot measures?
Yeah, so we have to so there's initiatives. That's where where people are bringing initiatives themselves, are collecting signatures, and you know we're following them the second that they file with the Secretary of State that they want to collect signatures. We're on top of it and we're aware of all the important deadlines. And then there's legislatively referred ballot measures where they're passing bills, and every state has different rules around that. One of the most interesting sort of long-term legislative election impacts is Nevada and Pennsylvania are two examples of this. In those states, if you have to pass a bill in two consecutive sessions for it to become a ballot measure, well, what happens if party changes in between those two sessions and a chamber flips? That ballot measure goes back to square one. That's happened a number of times over the years, and that's always one of those really interesting situations with the ballot measure landscape. So every state has its own different rules, just like running elections. Ballot measures are always very different. Not every state has initiatives. So for us, it's really just about, over the last 15 years, we've perfected our approaches as to how you follow and monitor all the statewide ballot measures, when they're filed, when their deadlines are, and just keep you on top of that.
So, you know, in the Commonwealth of Virginia, I usually found that there was a lot of desire for information on ballot measures. Hmm. For example, they would only give us a little bit of money for advertising, but that was used every single time. And we'd always get calls from voters asking for more information on the ballot measures because there's simply not a lot of, as you said, advertisements or discussion where voters are getting information, just basic information. So do you think this is one of the causes that you found this niche with ballot measures?
Yeah, I really think we like to say internally, it's our flagship project. Don't tell anyone else in the other teams, but it is our flagship project. It's where the vast majority of our sort of traffic and attention comes because it's a really important niche space for us. You know, we love our competitors and we love Wikipedia that's out there, but what we've actually found over the years is that there really aren't very many articles anymore on Wikipedia about ballot measures because we've got that. Right. There's really no need for it otherwise. And I think that's because it's a really interesting part of the election landscape where it's both complicated and confusing and there's not a lot of information out there about it. And that's pretty unique. I mean, often, you know, with the presidential election, for instance, there's a million different websites and a million different articles you can read about the presidential election. It's limitless. Or, you know, even on some of those local down ballot elections, especially say in a partisan race, well, you know, you can go read about a partisan election for coroner, which exists in some cases, or some voters are perfectly content to say, I see a D, I see an R, that's enough information for me to go off of. I don't really need to do much more than that.
But I've always wondered what Democratic and Republican policy on coroners really is, but somebody will let me know someday.
Yeah. Oh, it's amazing how many elected officials we have and how many of them are partisan in some cases. But that's really, at the local level, it's really just information and knowledge. You know, we see in some cases people really like having the ideological label next to the name because it imparts information. It's kind of like in Nebraska, this has always been one of my sort of favorite stories to tell, and we tell our new staff about it, and we talk about it internally a lot. The Nebraska State Senate is technically nonpartisan.
Right.
When you go to the voting booth, and if you live in Nebraska, you are seeing a nonpartisan ballot ID next to those candidates for state senate. But it's not true. They're not nonpartisan. They are all ideologically aligned. They're all partisan aligned. And everybody inside the state capitol knows who the Ds are and who the Rs are. All the journalists know the Ds and the Rs, all the lobbyists, all the activists, everybody but the voters. So we decided a long time ago, we said, well, yes, technically these are nonpartisan elections, but we're going to call them Ds and Rs because there are very simple ways you can do that. The Democrats and Republican parties of Nebraska will endorse, so that tells you very clearly. And then you can also, in Nebraska, among about 30 other states, you can look up voter registration status. So if someone's a registered Democrat or a registered Republican, that's probably what they are. So it sometimes gets a bad rap, the partisan status, but really it's just information to pass along to voters.
So I think Ballotpedia also has information on races and results. Can you talk about that? I think that that's something that the voters obviously seek out after the election.
Yeah. Well, the first thing I guess I'll just mention that is there's a significant amount of uncontested elections in this country. And we like to draw attention to it because it's kind of alarming whenever we talk to voters about this. People tend to think, wow, politics, it's so supercharged. Everyone's really fired up. It must mean that there's a lot of candidates running for office. And the reality is that that's not true. We have a new monthly report that we publish at Ballotpedia now. And what we found so far this year is like 70% of all elections we've covered this year were uncontested. You know, I talked earlier about the number of canceled races. There's just a lot of uncontested elections in the country. It's not giving voters choice. It's not giving voters an option at the polls. So even though there is a lot of energy, there are quite a large number of uncontested elections. What we found between 2018 and 2023 was that 58% of the elections that we covered at Ballotpedia were uncontested, almost two-thirds. And it's just to us, it always feels like a really staggering number of elections. And that's because most voters pay attention to congressional elections. Now, those are not uncontested, but that's just 535 elections. State legislatures, there are 7,386 of them, usually about a third of them are uncontested, and that's what we've seen consistently over the last 20 years. And the numbers are even more pronounced the more localized you get. And those elections where your vote really counts in some respects because, you could go to a small town in North Carolina and there are 19 people voting, and it's going to be a 10-9 election. That's it. So those local races being uncontested, those local races are really, really, it's pretty pronounced.
And then on the other side, from the non-competitive to the super competitive races, and especially, again, people who think about running elections are really often put under the spotlight when the race is extremely close, when there's some counting issues getting to the first count, when there are recounts, when there are challenges. Some of our great historical issues like Bush v. Gore are really around that. So tell us a little bit about sort of coverage of that, the races that are really close and the follow-up to elections as they pass by election day to final resolution.
Yeah, we like to call it the aftermath of an election. The election doesn't just end when the voter goes and casts their vote. One of the things at Ballotpedia that we actually find that we really help in the election space with is with all the rules about what happens. So Ballotpedia, we have election results. We're there on election night covering everything. But, we recognize and know that people are probably not coming to us at 8:01 p.m. after polls close looking for results. But what they are looking for are the rules. So if a race is really close and someone says, well, gosh, is there going to be a recount here? What is the stipulation of when a recount would happen? How does that work? We have all the rules around that, and we make that available. And that's a really important part of how we contribute to results analysis, to results collection, to what happens after an election, because every state has different rules around that. Some states, they're going to require a recount based on the percentage threshold, maybe it's 0.5%. In some states, the candidate has to request it. Some states, the candidate has to pay for it. In some states, the state will pay for it. In some states, they won't have a runoff unless the candidate requests it, but the candidate could choose not to request it, like in North Carolina. So there's all unique sets of rules around this. And actually, one of my favorite, although my team doesn't like this rule, but I think it's most interesting, is in Texas, some school boards can call their own election if they feel like it. They don't need permission from a county or a state official. They can say, we're going to have an election, and we're administering it, and we're running it. That's just one of the very unique and rare rules that we have in this country.
Interesting. Well, I know our listeners are already users of Ballotpedia. I think they've learned a lot with this fleshing out of a lot of the tools you have. But before we get to our final couple of questions, is there anything else you think our listeners should know about Ballotpedia and the ways they might use it that maybe they're not doing today?
Well, it's a great question. With nearly 500,000 articles, they could spend quite a bit of time having fun reading and learning about their elections. I would just say that the simplest thing is to take the time to be curious. Take the time to learn about the elections or whatever political rules are relevant to the jurisdiction you're living in, whether it's city or a school board or a statewide ballot measure. We're here to help, and we probably have something that can make it easier for you to participate, to feel like you are happily engaged in the process and not feeling a little bit dirty and jaded by it all.
So we always end our podcast with two questions. I'll ask the first, and Don will close us out as usual.
I'm ready.
The first really is, so how did you get into elections? And now that you know a lot, you've built up a great body of knowledge, what would you tell your prior self, that naive Jeff Pallet, who didn't know what he knows today about elections?
So I got into elections from just starting to work at Ballotpedia. Before that, I was working as a journalist and as a think tank writer. And no disrespect to think tank writers, but I started working at Ballotpedia, and what I realized really quickly was, boy, it's really rewarding to see millions of people reading your content, knowing that what you're doing is not trying to change their mind, but what you're trying to do is help them. And it's not just a handful of people reading something that maybe sat on a bookshelf for a few weeks gathering dust, but they're people that are actually getting ready to participate, and they're so grateful that you've helped them. So I started when I left the field of journalism and think tank writing, I came into the world of Ballotpedia. For me personally, it was like intoxicating to know the impact that we were having, to kind of sit back and realize, yeah, this is really cool. And then the next thing I know, it was 14 years later, and I'm still doing it, and I wouldn't look back and wouldn't be anywhere else. So Ballotpedia has been an amazingly rewarding place, and being in elections and being in sort of civics is really a wonderful way to contribute to our election administration and to our American political system.
So, Jeff, you've been involved with elections and with Ballotpedia for over a decade.
Yeah.
So what's a funny or notable story that you could share with our listeners that just sort of makes you laugh?
So the one that came to mind for me is actually a pre-Ballotpedia story, and I was just trying to think of, you know, no one wants to hear about my kids or things that happen in college or anything like that, but I did have one of those interesting experiences in my journalism era where I did get to yell "Stop the presses," which is not something that happens anymore because no one actually prints anything on the presses, but I got to yell "Stop the presses" because I was working at a little newspaper and we were getting ready to go to print. It was late in the evening. Everyone had gone home, and former President Ford died. That was right in the moment when that happened. And everyone's looking around. They're like, well, stop the presses. And, you know, it's not exactly the most interesting story maybe to some listeners, but for a journalist or someone who's in, you know, elections, those are the kind of quirky moments you hear about, but you don't always get to experience. So I had a lot of fun actually looking back on that. It was an adrenaline rush. You're running around as fast as you can. I imagine in some respects that a lot of election administrators have, you know, those frantic moments where your adrenaline spikes, and then after the fact you look back on it and you think, did I handle that right? Was that the right decision? I think it worked out okay. We changed the headline, and the next day readers of that newspaper got to find out that former President Ford had passed away.
Well, this is the time in the podcast where I say stop the podcast and want to thank Jeff Pallet, the editor-in-chief of Ballotpedia.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you for listening to The Voting Booth, a podcast of the American Enterprise Institute. This program was produced by Jay Hung Lee and hosted by John Fortier and Don Palmer. If you enjoyed this episode, we encourage you to subscribe to The Voting Booth wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening, and tune in next time.